through water, will go through the earth. He has built some scalar communication systems. He's built a whole series, a rather large number of different kinds of scalar antennas and scalar detectors. He's worked out a beautiful series of very sophisticated detection instruments that allows him to detect scalar waves from storms, scalar waves that are placed onto weather and so forth by the Soviet Union, measure the scalar caps that the Soviet Union has placed into the Earth itself and put the Earth in scalar resonance, and he has in fact mapped the entire scalar resonance frequency responses of the Earth up to quite a large number.
Mm-hmm. Where does he work?
He works independently. He's an independent inventor all by himself. He's also done some extremely fundamental work in the field of boosting up the power of radionics. We had the privilege of being present when John Bedini took his scalar wave detector and measured that instrument and proved conclusively it does put out scalar waves. He's done a large number of things like that. Ramon Sanchez, I named Professor Sanchez, has done a lot of experiments in with a scalar in the microwave frequency, like 5 gigahertz and so forth, with the beams and crossing the beams and extracting energy and the little cold explosion over water and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I named John Bedini.
Yeah.
Didn't give a complete list of names, but those are the main ones that I had named. I named Howard Johnson. Howard, as you know, has a patent on a permanent magnet motor, and Howard personally demonstrated to me that he had a rotary device, and he personally demonstrated to me that he can make a North Pole attract a North Pole, and I'm telling you, anybody can do that can make a motor.
Where's Professor Sanchez based?
He's in Los Angeles.
And has he said he's done a lot of mapping of scalar potentials?
That was Frank Golden.
Oh, that, okay. Well, have either of them published the results anywhere?
No. They don't intend to.
Why is that?
Well,
for
one thing, you get yourself threatened if you do. For another thing, if you publish real definitive results and you're trying to be an inventor, what you wind up doing is giving away your invention. And so many of them are trying to bring certain things to the patent area so that they can market them and then go ahead from there.
So publishing, C. Craig, is not the reason for invention. The reason for invention is to move it into the marketplace.
Well, sure.
Now, I would name some other folks. I would certainly, I have the greatest admiration for Professor William Tiller, who's built a very fundamental detector, in my opinion. I have and done some enormous work in all kinds of areas that are on the far-flung frontiers of science. I have great admiration for Dr. Robert Beck, who has personally demonstrated at some personal expense and some hazard to himself, scalar communication systems, the scalar transmitters and receivers that go through Faraday cages, and he's done a lot of work in ELF and so forth long before it was fashionable to know the effects of those kinds of devices, and so I'd certainly include him in the area. I would include people like Bill Bice and Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, Pete Kelly in radionics. Certainly I would include Dr. Hieronymus, the founder of the modern phase of amplified radionics. I would include him as a very great inventor and pioneer in this area.
So there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people out there, Craig.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, I know that.
And they are very impressive people, and their work is very, very impressive.
The problem that they have, Craig, is that because it's unorthodox work, there are no provisions for funding in this area. There are also no provisions for a lot of the things we take for granted in science. For example, if I want to do research in ordinary science, I can go down to the library and I've got the resources of the world at my fingertips. If I can't find a book or a paper anywhere else, I can get it directly out of the Library of Congress long enough to get a copy. But in this area, there's not even anybody doing card cataloging or cataloging the material or digesting the material or giving you an abstract or a review of what it means or anything like that. We don't have the resources or anything to do that. We don't have really good journals in this area at all because nobody has the monetary resources to do that.
Right.
We could certainly get along a lot faster and a lot quicker if we did have some resources to set up the standard things you'd like to do to be able to share all the information with everybody else starting anew.
Right. Well,
one of the things we can tell you we are doing, this show will be made available on cassette form. We'll tell you more about that. But You're getting a lot of information here tonight from John and from Tom, and that will be made available to you very quickly.
The reason I asked about publishing is, since you're asking people to do research at universities, I would think it would be very helpful to those people, or to, you know, to motivate those people, to give them something to work with, to start with.
Bill?
If there was published information.
Craig?
Yeah.
We will make available a tape on the pendulum generator.
Mm-hmm. I think you ought to say that louder, John. I don't think that came over too clear.
We,
Excuse me. I had my mic off.
Yeah, turn it back on.
The little things. We will make available a tape on the pendulum generator, Craig, with laboratory measurements, orthodox rules.
So that you can see the doll.
So that you can make it yourself.
And with that, we're going to have to run, Craig.
Right.
And I appreciate your questions. They're always very thought-provoking, and that's the reason I give you a little extra time.
Okay, I appreciate everything you're doing up there.
All right.
Down
Dad, yeah, you're way up in Northern California tonight.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Tom. Dave. Hi, Dave. Welcome aboard.
Hello, Tom. How are you tonight?
Fine. How's it going, Dave?
Very good. Now, I think I want to ask Mr. Bedini the first question. On the return from the battery to the motor, what is that direct from the battery back to the motor, or how is it wired?
I will explain this to you.
I'm just interested in the return to make the pulse.
The return path is nothing more than a pulse.
What's the electrical connection?
The electrical connection is as the monopole portion of the magnet goes past the generating coils.
Right.
The motor turns itself off.
Yeah.
After the push.
All right.
You then supply the pulse energy back to the battery through a rectifier. So what you're looking for is a current with high potential. You want a high voltage spike back to that battery. This then is...
That comes out of the induction coil, the pickup coil, right?
That's right. That's exactly how this system works. And I will tell you that I disconnected them tonight to bring them to KABC. But the pendulum has been running for about 14 to 15 days constantly. If you want to measure the battery right at this moment, I will guarantee you that it's at 13 volts.
13-volt battery.
Well, it's your standard lead-acid cells that make up a 12-volt battery.
All right, what's the... what's the output of the motor then?
1.2 watts.
For the voltage?
12 volts.
All right.
And it will run down as low as 5 1/4 volts.
Yeah.
Will push the pendulum. But I don't worry about what's going in. I worry about what's coming out and being returned to the battery.
That's right.
You see, if you can engineer a motor that never draws any more current, you've just beaten all the theory.
Yeah, but you're using a cobalt magnet, too.
Well, I could use a regular barium ferrite magnet. I can still engineer the same system given any set of tools.
What about using something like a plutonium magnet?
I don't know of one. Maybe neodymium iron. That's the newest one that I know of. I've never heard of a plutonium magnet. But
it would be expensive, I know
that.
Yeah. All right, now... I think that answered that question. Now, I think Mr. Bearden, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dave.
All right. Now, you were talking about the vacuum of the gravity, right?
0 point of gravity, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking about the gravitational field in the sense, in the pure general relativistic sense, where what we mean by gravitational field is curvature of space-time.
All right, well, now, doesn't the gravity rely on the vector of the mass, the frequency of the mass to create a vacuum?
How about restating that? You went by me.
Well, I was going to say on the gravity, don't we rely on the vector? the frequency of the mass to create the vacuum?
No. The vacuum is considered to be a separate state.
Well, the vacuum has to be created by the mass.
No. It's the other way around. In general relativity, the only thing that mass really is, fundamentally, is a kink or a curvature in space-time, and you can identify space-time with vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to say the mass creates a vacuum in the time-space frequency related to the mass itself.
No, the mass does not create the vacuum. As a matter of fact, the best theories of the universe allow the vacuum to assume excited states all by itself and pump itself up and then to explode, so to speak, as it decays back down to the ground state. And that's what is about the best theory we've had right now on how the whole thing with the mass and everything in it got going.
Well, now, wouldn't you have to have the frequency of the vacuum?
No, the vacuum has every frequency in it you can name.
Yeah, but the frequency of the mass that's created within the vacuum itself.
Are you talking about the virtual mass?
Yes.
Virtual particles?
Yes.
Well, there are virtual photons, virtual particles, and virtual everything else.
Each one has its own frequency.
Hey, gentlemen, I have a virtual frequency that I've got to do right now. if you don't mind, I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Mark, and we'll take a break. Dave, I want you to wrap up your questions to Tom real fast because we're running short of time.
Let me finish the answer to that last question.
I didn't finish it.
Dave, I think what you're asking is correct in this fashion. Scalar-wise, I regard the mass per se, any kind of mass, as a standing scalar wave, a standing wave in vacuum. It's locked in, trapped by the spin of a particle, for example.
That's true, but it still has to have the physical mass.
That's correct. The mass itself is the standing wave. The inertia and all that's due to that. Now, in the sense that you give a structure to that mass, for example, if it's a proton, and I consider it to be made of partons and so forth,
yeah.
then it's a complex of trapped scalar resonances.
That's right, but now... you have to figure the vector of the mass to arrive at the frequency.
30 seconds, guys.
No, it's the other way around. We figure the mass from the fact of the amplitude of that complex or that single standing wave. And in fact, we can decrease the mass and inertia, or we can increase it by increasing the scalar resonance.
That's absolutely right.
All right, listen, guys, I know, Dave, we haven't quite got your question answered here.
Well,
we're going to take a little break. If you want to hang on the phone, it's perfectly all right with me, okay?
All right, I'll stick around.
All right, stick around.
All right.
Radionics devices, bioenergetics devices, the things that are going to change your world and mine. And let's continue on with, I believe, Dave, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, Dave, let's finish this matter about mass and vacuum that you and Tom were talking about.
Are you there, Tom?
Yes.
All right, now, maybe I was a little bit wrong in what I said. What I was trying to get over is that the mass in molecular physics requires a frequency and the vector to create the vacuum. Now, without the vacuum, the molecular physics wouldn't hold true. Due to the fact that the molecular structure would disintegrate.
Well, that's certainly true. That without the vacuum, you wouldn't have a physical universe at all, because everything's made of vacuum, matter, everything else.
That's what I'm trying to explain.
Exactly right.
Right. All right. Now, one thing I don't understand, how to do away with the vacuum.
You can't do away with it. The vacuum is at a very high stress level.
Yes, I know it is.
And what you can do is change or pattern that stress. You can make the direction in which you oscillate waves of stress up and down, just like a sound wave in the ocean or something.
That's right.
And you can make directional patterns and so forth. But you see, given the ability to do that, we've done what is called polarizing the vacuum. And if you can do that, you can do some rather magnificent things.
Yeah, but if we could break down the molecular structure, the vacuum ceased to exist.
So far as I know, I don't... You know, with what we're talking about, the electromagnetics, we certainly don't have the power to do that. The kinds of things they're talking about when they say the vacuum reached this super excited state and then decayed, exploded, and so forth to to create the universe as we know it. And that kind of a theory, the kinds of energies and the kinds of things they're talking about are so far beyond the kinds of energies we're using that, you know, we're not in that ballgame at all. So I really don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, well, I was working on that type of a theory and trying to work it out. I misplaced a lot of my papers, and I don't know where they are. I haven't found them.
Uh-huh.
And, but I'd worked this idea out into a feasible equation. And I misplaced my papers, and I can't remember remember the exact theory now.
Well, there you are.
Okay.
All I can say is more and more of the vacuum in modern physics is assuming ever more importance every day. That's certainly true.
That's very true.
All right, does that help you, Dave?
Yeah, it does a lot, Tom, and Bill, and I thank you very much, and I thank you, Tom, and I thank you, John.
Well, thank you, Dave, for tuning in.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Glad to have you aboard.
Okay.
We're getting some good questions here tonight, guys, and let's see what Edson has on his mind.
Good evening, everybody.
How are you?
How are you? First, a couple of comments about Tesla. As you know, I'm always writing about Tesla. First, that the late Orson Welles' last movie was The Secret, Nikola Tesla, but that's hardly mentioned in the tributes to that great personality.
The movie did not get seen by too many people.
No, and it's kind of hard to even find a copy that's still in America.
It did not say good things about J.P. Morgan in Wall Street.
No, not at all.
I've watched the movie 100 times.
Well, maybe they'll bring it back and show it in some art theater in L.A. I hope they do. Also, if any of your listeners know anything about the Tesla Pierce Arrow car that's supposed to operate on free energy.
It's here in Southern California somewhere, but we can't find it.
Yeah, well, perhaps somebody can contact you, and then we can get in touch with you, because Nick Basura, as you know, he's a great Tesla fan, and I are trying to track down what happened to this Pierce Arrow. Still around someplace. Now, I worked for several years with the late Dr. Albert Roy Davis, and he wrote a book, Magnetism and Its Effects on the Living System. And one of the chapters in this book has to do with the gravitational effect, that is, magnetic effect on weight, gravitational weight. And I wonder if this has to do with your generator, if it loses some weight in the magnetic field.
Yes, it does.
Uh-huh. Could you give the Gauss strength of the magnets that you
it's
use?
It's samarium cobalt, and I'm not quite sure on the Gauss of this magnet, but I will tell you the physical size.
Mm-hmm.
It's a half inch in diameter by a little bit less than a quarter inch.
That's
running these machines.
I see. Is there a moon tidal effect on your generator?
Yes, there is. Uh-huh. And I was going to mention that, and that's a very good question, because when the full moon comes out, the pendulum does pick up the same way as the ocean bulges.
Ah, well, we got that this evening. How about the figure 8 effect of the electrons? Lissajou electronic display, is that involved with the generator?
You can do it that way, and you will find out that it's not quite a figure 8.
Mm-hmm. What if you took, I understand this is operating, is it counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere?
It seems that all the energy machines want to run, yes, counterclockwise in this hemisphere.
What if you took this to the magnetic equator of the Earth? Would there be a loss of power?
I haven't been able to do that kind of testing because I'm very limited right at this moment.
Uh-huh.
We suspect it would run in either direction on the true equator.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
In January, I'm going to go down to Fiji. We'll stop on the equator.
But we can engineer the systems to run either direction in this hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question for Colonel Bearden. I talked to Dr. Jastrow last night on Ray Bream's show, and it was about Star Wars, particle beams, and so on. Now, Dr. Jastrow says that the Russians are planning to use MHD, magnetohydrodynamic generators, to power these particle beam weapons that actually Tesla invented way back in the 30s. And I remember that Colonel Bearden said something about the use of this death ray of Tesla's in Afghanistan. Perhaps you could comment on that again. And could you, gentlemen, give us an address to write to Bedini Electronics, is it, and Colonel Bearden?
I'll give you the address right now. Have you got a pencil and paper?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you want information on this particular generator or any of the books that pertain to this, there's two places to get them. One is the Tesla Book Company at 1580 Magnolia Boulevard in Melbrae, California.
Uh-huh.
I don't know the zip right offhand. And the other
94030.
94030.
Okay.
And the other is Bedini Electronics, P.O. Box 769, San Fernando, California, 913341.
341. Okay.
I always get the two numbers mixed up between Silmar and San Fernando.
Yeah. So does Colonel Bearden know about the death ray, any more about the death ray being used?
A little bit. Let me give you an address since you wanted that too.
Mm-hmm.
My address is Post Office Box 1472, Huntsville, Alabama, 35807. As far as the death ray that they're using, if you have a very powerful scalar beam and you hit the human nervous system with it, the nervous system is highly nonlinear. It's not built at all like a bunch of wires carrying ordinary currents. You have something very much resembling a spark detector almost.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens if you hit the scalar nervous system, the scalar part of the nervous system with a strong scalar beam, you simply cut off the entire nervous system, and that's instantaneous death. Now, in Afghanistan, a very strange thing has been noted, and it's the fact that this occurs, not the fact that it's scalar at all, but the fact that this occurs has been documented in places like Jane's Defense Weekly. When the high-end helicopters, for example, come in, they've been using gas against the Afghans and testing things like mustard gas and nerve gas and so forth. And, of course, the gas kills people, and nerve gas kills them very quickly. But even with nerve gas, a biological system, it takes a short time to die. And during that time, the system convulses. Now, if you've ever seen an animal or anything killed with nerve gas, it's terrible convulsions for at least a few seconds, like half a minute or so. And a human does the same thing. But there is a... So the Hind will come in and it will fire rockets, you know, and deliver the gas and so forth, and people will die with mustard gas or they will die with nerve gas symptoms. But then there's another kind, and they're referring to it in Afghanistan as smirch.
Hmm.
This kind, the body dies instantly right where it's at. It never makes another move, and apparently the nervous system never fires another signal anywhere. It collapses like a limp rag right there. That's it. Total instantaneous death. No chemical that I know of will do that. The other thing is, at least one occasion that is documented, an entire village was wiped out this way after the fighting guerrillas, the Mujahideen, had left. And they were able to come back to the village about 30 days later. And the bodies of all the villagers who had been killed this way had not decayed at all. No decay whatsoever in 30 days. The reason for that, apparently, was the normal things that happen when a body dies, like turning loose of enzymes and all kinds of things, because normally a body dies by degrees. And the other things that the bacteria and all that are in the body, apparently all the bacteria were killed, and the body died instantly, didn't turn loose any of the enzymes or anything, and so no decay occurred. So apparently the Soviet Union has been using, very slyly, and doing a little testing with tactical scalar beams in an anti-personnel role in Afghanistan from behind the helicopter. That's my opinion, at least.
Well,
there's a great deal of data to support that opinion.
I may have some information on that, Tom.
Okay.
I have been doing experiments with a high-voltage Tesla coil, and I'll tell you what I've been doing. I have been purifying water by capturing the ozone, which kills all the bacteria. Now, maybe what may be happening is you're getting little electrical sparks inside the body cells, and the ozone from that little electrical spark is curing or killing the bacteria that would normally start to occur in that process.
That may be the explanation.
Okay, now I only know that because of the experiments that I've been doing on bacteria to find a way to clean up all our water for L.A.
Right.
Which needs all the help it can get.
We need a lot of help and a lot of water all over the country.
And I'll tell you, the easiest solution for that is the Tesla coil.
But it's not chemicals, and so therefore the aircraft will not fire.
Right. It doesn't have anything to do with chemicals, and there's a very unique way to do that, and that's produce the high voltage and suck the ozone from that high voltage and bubble it through the water. And within 5 minutes, the chlorine and everything and all the bacteria is dead in that water, and you have pure water.
Well, you know, we need to do something, because the primary way we purify water with the chlorine is diabolical. The intake of chlorine into the body when we drink water is not good for you at all. It's been at least implicated in heart disease. And it's even to the point now where they're warning you about taking showers, because when you beat the water on something like you do when you're taking a shower, well, you free more chlorine and you breathe it in. You get it direct in the lungs, you get it direct in your bloodstream. So it's sort of between a rock and a hard place. We use the chlorine so that the water doesn't make us sick, and yet over a long period of years, the chlorine can contribute to disease and decay.
Well, we don't allow any in our house. The chlorine is all gone.
It's a pretty bad situation, though, Bill, when you start to get, you know, a system like that supplies L.A., and you can't even put fish in the water because they just die and float upside down.
And we're supposed to drink that.
Well, and all the people that have had problems because of the ammonia. But one solution is that ozone generators, not that it's good for you to breathe it yourself internally, but it can clear up the water. I mean, you could just put a little ozone in the reservoir and never worry about bacteria again. It just refuses to live.
All right, Edson, you see what you triggered here?
Yeah, great. There's going to be a cassette tape of this show, I don't understand.
Yes, there will be this show, the Weather War show we did with Tom Bearden some time back, the one with Dr. Marcel Vogel, the one with Dr. Berg about the Kabbalah, and the one in 2 weeks with Robert Monroe and the out-of-body experience, when we'll have the out-of-body travelers from Virginia come right into our studio, investigate, go back to Virginia, and check back with us.
Oh, that's great.
So those will all be available to you.
Really great show.
All right.
Thank you.
Hey, Bill, while I can interject a point here, since you mentioned that Weather War tape, I wanted to mention that we found evidence that the thing I've been calling the giant radio from the ground, where you see a large thing, has actually been photographed from satellites and is being called in the literature the enhanced V. I'm talking about the letter V.
Uh-huh.
And it has been photographed from satellites, and I'll give a real quick reference since this will be on the tape, and you can pursue it from there. National Weather Digest, Volume 10, Number 2, May 1985. Along about page 7, there's an article that will give you references to the enhanced V, and will show you some pictures taken by satellite of that effect.
By the way, two observers here in Southern California saw the radials the other night. Mr. Bedini, Mr. Jenkins.
Well, good.
It was too dark to get videotape of those, although we do have the other videotapes.
We're watching for you, Tom.
Good.
We're also taking tuner measurements of what's going on.
Well, I just wanted to bring out the fact that the thing has been spotted from the satellites, and it has been definitely associated with severe weather.
Now, the Weather War show was fascinating, and I might point out that the article in Let's Talk magazine, which will be out in the next week or so, is based upon Tom's material, and we'll have some photographs in there for you in the magazine and some graphics, and go over some of the data that we have covered before. So I hope everybody will be getting their copy of Let's Talk. All right, Edson, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back with John Bedini to define a scalar wave, if you would.
Okay. I'll do it two ways. First of all, imagine you have a steel plate, that's your medium, and you have a set of forces on both sides pushing in so that they balance and sum to zero. Okay, leave the set of forces on there. That plate is under stress. That's a quite different plate from a plate that has no forces at all acting on it, even though the resultant of those forces is zero. Now imagine that the forces are being produced by, say, two hands, a bunch of fingers. You increase the force with which you're pushing, but they still sum to zero. And you do it all at the same time, and you regularly increase and decrease the force with which you're pushing, but they always sum to zero. In that plate, you have a rhythmic stress wave, but never did the plate have a resultant force acting on it to push it in one direction or the other. It's a squeeze and relax wave. Okay, that's a scalar wave. If you do this now in vacuum, where you have electric fields and or magnetic fields opposing themselves or adding together to make a zero, and you increase and decrease the magnitude of all of those forces, but they always remain sum to zero, the energy of each one of those waves is locked in there in that system that sums to a zero vector. And so as you increase the forces, everything is dynamic at base, you're increasing the energy and decreasing the energy density of vacuum. And by definition, by pure general relativity, that is a gravitational wave. What you have done is you have taken electromagnetic field energy, force field energy, and turned it into gravitational potential field energy. And that is a scalar wave. A scalar electric.